Support for this public radio podcast comes from the dairy families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont. On the web at go.coop.
You better come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be raining out
door. Come over here, kid, what's up? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil, and you fry some garlic.
It's
then you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. And you gotta do a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? And a little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet. My country, tis of thee. I eat for social progress. I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour. I'm Michelle Anna Jordan. Thanks for tuning in. I think you'll really like tonight's show. It's the last episode of 2007. We're introducing a new feature on Mouthful, book reviews by Laura Hager, who will be a regular contributor to the Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour. But first, our remarkable guest. Judith Jones, who stopped by KRCB during her book tour in November, has witnessed a transformation in the way Americans cook and eat. She has worked as an editor since the 1940s, and with her husband, Evan Jones, co-authored several books, including The Book of Bread and The Book of New England Cookery. Now she's written a memoir, one that is not so much about herself as it is about the transformation of American cooking and eating, which she witnessed as up close and personal as anyone. Indeed, she is one of the midwives of the transformation. She has worked with everyone from a young Julia Child to the distinguished Jacques Pepin. She coaxes stories not so much from eager writers hungry to be published, there's so many of those today, but from people whom she believed had something essential, something crucial, and something enduring to contribute to the canon of cookery. And through much of her career, she continued to work with writers and poets, John Hershey, Elizabeth Bowen, and John Updike among them, not involved in cooking. Jones did not set out to be an editor of cookbooks. Her first contribution to literature came when she was working in Paris, and she was assigned the task of sending rejection letters to the authors of a stack of manuscripts. One of those was Anne Frank, Diary of a Young Girl. Instead of doing as her boss asked, she pulled the manuscript from the pile of rejects and convinced the American publisher to release it. Yet food and cooking seem to be at the heart of what Jones loves. The title of her memoir, The Tenth Muse, refers to Gasteria, the goddess of the pleasures of taste. Here's our conversation. Judith, welcome to Mouthful.
Well, it's lovely to be here.
Sorry you have rain today, but, you know, that part of California is beautiful, too.
Mm-hmm. It is. And it's full of many memories for me.
Yeah, you came here often.
I did come out here often because I was working with M.F.K. Fisher and with Marion Cunningham on the Fanny Farmer book and then the books that she later did. And so I really kind of discovered this part of the world.
At a really wonderful time, too.
Mm-hmm.
But before we get to that part, one of the things I was fascinated by in your book is much of your career sort of turned to some degree on the loss of your purse.
Mm-hmm.
While you were in Paris.
Yep.
Will you tell us about that?
Well, I had this love of food, and I was, of course, dying to go to France. But I was also 24 years old, and I had my first job at Doubleday as a junior editor. And so I had only, I think they gave me a three-week vacation. And it was the last day, or just 2 days before my ship was to sail back. And I was sitting in the Tuileries Gardens, and, you know, you have a shoulder bag, and I tossed it on the bench behind me. And I was thinking, I just can't bear to leave the city. Why am I? How could I possibly stay? Well, I got up as it was getting to be dark, and I got up, and I left that purse on the bench behind me. And 2 minutes later, of course, I realized what I'd done, and it was gone. And it had my passport, all my money, my traveler's checks, my identity. And I thought, this is telling me something. I think I'm supposed to stay here. And so I did. I stayed for 3.5 years.
And during that time, it seems like your palette really expanded. You were very adventurous all along.
Yeah. I just love the whole way of life. I love the way the French shopped, going twice a day, you know, to the bakery and to the vegetable place and to the charcuterie. And the appreciation of food was just something so deep in them. And I connected with it. And I didn't have cookbooks. Later when I met my husband, we started experimenting together, and we would literally ask the fishmonger when we bought a nice big piece of dorade, how would you cook it? And then I'd go home and cook it. And I remember once asking somebody at the open market who was a butcher, and I said, how do you really... I'm buying a steak, and I want to make French fries the way the French do it. And so he introduced me to his wife, and his wife said, the secret is part beef fat, part pork fat. I'll give you just the right proportion, which she did. And I went home and made pretty good French fries. So it was really a journey of discovery. And when I came back, I just somehow had to carry that on.
But you weren't at that point you were working for publishers, but you weren't working in the cookbook realm. In fact, there wasn't a cookbook.
No, there weren't cookbooks.
No,
the
not like we think of today. Right.
They just sort of learned at grandmother's knee, and there were a few good books, but it wasn't a way of life the way it has become here. So it was when I got home that I realized how much I didn't know. I mean, about technique and the difference between really just making a pretty good stew and making that really beautiful French unctuous beef bourguignon. So I'd been at Knopf a while, I think almost a year, working mostly with French translations, but everybody knew I liked to cook. So when by a certain serendipity this huge manuscript arrived on my desk by an unknown Smith College girl, Julia Child, who was she, and two French women, I just felt it was an answer to everything I was looking for, and I just had to convince the rest of the world. But we did.
You did. You did an incredible job, and it took a really remarkable number of years for Julia to complete and work on that book. Could you talk a little bit about that?
She worked for years on it, yes. Actually, it's sort of fun to read my book in parallel with her book, My Life in France, which was her memoir of her years in France and how she became who she was and how she did the book. And we were there at the same time. We could have crossed paths, but we didn't until later. And she had taken cooking at the Cordon Bleu, and she wanted to connect with some French women, which she did. They had a little circle of gourmands, les trois gourmands. And she wanted to start teaching and met this woman, Simone Beck, who's very, very French and really didn't think Americans could possibly understand French cooking. But Julia knew how to work with her and get the best from her. And the two French women had been working on a cookbook for Americans, and they realized they weren't really getting anywhere and they didn't know what Americans wanted. And so they asked Julia if she would join them. Well, you can imagine that was just what Julia was waiting for. And it really was Julia's concept that you, one, had to teach Americans all about French cooking, teach them technique, teach them the whys and wherefores, teach them about ingredients and what made the difference between a good beef bourguignon, drying the meat, not frying it in too hot butter, it would burn, all these little details that make all the difference. And so it very much became Julia's book. Also the whole idea of master recipes and variations, which was a very interesting concept, because if you focus on the master recipe and learn all the rules, then you can apply it to a little veal stew or lamb stew or what have you.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you mark the publication of that book as sort of the beginning of the new era of American cooking that we're in now?
I think Julia really did change the way cookbooks should be written. I'm afraid today we've slipped a bit because we're going back to these terrible short formula recipes and you don't hear the voice of the chef, the cook.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
I love to use that expression, which you can find. In a bowl, combine the first mixture with the second mixture. That's not cookbook writing. Julie would say, plop it in a bowl and with your hands squish it around. And what is combining? What's the first mixture? And then you go back and try to find, oh, the first mixture was that little bit of milk I heated with a teaspoon of sugar. I think it's very, very confusing. And then you set everything aside. What are you going to do, throw it out? I don't know. It's crazy.
Yeah, and I think what you said about it lacks voice. You don't hear someone talking to you. Mm-hmm. And certainly with Julia's recipes, there's a beauty.
There is.
A beauty to the voice that is in them.
It's visceral. And I think what Julia taught us was get rid of our inhibitions and just enjoy the physicality of food. You know, slap that chicken breast and massage it. She would say, because it likes it.
Now, one of the things I always admired about Julia was that she would always say, I'm not a chef, I'm a cook. And it seems to me your book just reinforces this over and over and over, that the era that we actually find ourselves in today, food-wise, you trace it back, and it was a renaissance in the home kitchen, not in restaurants. And, you know, today there's so much spectator sport involved with food.
Food has to be entertainment, and that's what's happened with the Food Network and a lot of the food shows. I mean, the lower the decollete, the more likely you're to have a successful cookbook.
But really, what you discovered and the people who you really brought to the world, there's so many. Claudia Roden, Mahdar Jaffery, Edna Lewis, someone I just so admire, Lydia Bastianich. These people, their traditions were home cooking and
home
regional
cooking.
Could you talk about that?
And so they had something in common in that most of them had to leave their homeland. In fact, everyone except for Edna, but she did leave the homeland of Virginia and go to the bigger city. But most of these people left that food of their childhood behind, and so it had a very powerful hold on them. It was a nostalgia for it, and cooking was bringing back the aunts and uncles all sitting around the table and enjoying. And because they were found themselves in a foreign country, Mahdar found herself in England, and Claudia Roden was first in France and then in London, and she had grown up in Cairo. They had to learn from scratch, just the way you and I do. And so they're good writers because they remember the little things that are important when you're teaching somebody else, much more than a chef who goes to chef school. And his whole performance is to put on a terrific show. I mean, fancy restaurant eating is theater. And that isn't what we're after at home.
Where do you see the balance between those two things right now? After you've been in publishing for 50 years, how do you see things happening today? Do you see sort of a bit of return to the table into real cooking among people who buy books?
Well, I think the balance always swings, and we go in one direction hysterically. We had the era of the fear of fat.
Is it over?
Dominated
please.
Everything. Of course, that swung back, and fat's okay for you, particularly if it's good, pure butter and not, you know, all these, what is the word, hydrogenated products. And so I feel kind of confident that we've almost had enough of And I'm not disparaging chefs, because they're wonderful, creative people, and you get ideas for them. But we've had enough of that kind of book, to the too expensive ingredients, and using a little fondant, you need just a tablespoon. Well, come on, who has fondant in there?
That reminds me of something you said in the book. I laughed so hard, I almost fell off the couch, talking about foam and all the foam on the plate.
Are we allowed to say it on radio?
Absolutely.
Well, I must say, this foam business, you know, and they not only just create foam, now they bake it, they do all everything with it. But I've never gotten over the fact that foam to me looks like what happens when my dog gets up in the country and he eats a whole lot of grass and he upchucks this green foam, and I can't get beyond it. I'm sorry.
You know, and I thought that was the best description of foam that I have ever heard. It's absolutely perfect.
Yeah.
Talking about living in various places, when you were living in Connecticut with Evan, you were
teaching. Vermont.
Was it Vermont?
That was when we were in New Hampshire.
Oh, New Hampshire, okay.
Yeah.
You tell a chilling story about when you're teaching, and something you say. You know, when this was during the McCarthy era, an era that I think doesn't get discussed enough these days. I'd love for you to tell that story.
And how it really touches on it did on our life. One reason we wanted to be in the country was to be a little freer and get back to the earth. I thought I'd have a family. And we stayed that first year, and I didn't have a job, so I offered myself as a substitute teacher, and I was called on a few times. And one time I was discussing the word allies, and the kid put his hand up and says, "What is an ally?" And I said, "Well, the allies are people you work with, you're friends with." And I said, for instance, our allies in World War II were Russia and England and France. And this little kid went home to his mother and said, "We had a teacher who said that Russia was our friend." And about a few weeks later, the local plumber who was on the school board came and called on us. And he said, "Did you say this?" And I said, "Yes, but it happens to be a historical fact." And he wasn't quite satisfied and asked us a few questions. He was puzzled because I had the shed all darkened. The shades were drawn. And he said, "What are you doing there?" And I said, "Well, I'm an amateur photographer, and I develop my own photographs." And then he turned to Evan, and he said, "And you've got a beard." This was long before everybody had beards. And Evan said, "Yeah, I like a beard. You don't have to shave so much." Something like that. And he was beginning to be satisfied and laughing a little bit with us, but just as he left, he turned back and he said to Evan, "And I hear you cook." And I thought that was so wonderful, because it was a reflection of the time in this sinister way, but also of an attitude toward cooking. I mean, it wasn't a thing for a He-Man man to do. So he must be a communist.
Now, you didn't do any more substitute teaching after that,
right?
No,
I didn't. No. No, I didn't want to go in that classroom.
Yeah, now, were there any other implications in your lives?
No, that was the only time. But I can remember when we got back to New York, and we had a little apartment near Third Avenue, which used to be lined with Irish pubs, and we'd sometimes go and have a drink there and watch television. We didn't have a television yet. And it was really sinister watching the McCarthy hearings develop, and the attitude in the bar was very, you know, there were some people who were all for him.
Yeah.
It was a very, very frightening time.
And I think that time has really good lessons for us today, if only for historical perspective and the inevitable swinging of the pendulum.
Yep.
But back to food. One of the things I love is your love of innards. You talk about it seems that you had a taste for those sorts of things very early on.
I did, and partly because I was exposed to them. I mean, English cooking, you do have beefsteak and kidney pie, and you have sweetbreads, well-breaded So you get that sort of lovely unctuous interior with the crusty outside. And lamb kidneys grilled and liver, of course. So I had all those things. And they were some of my favorite foods. I guess I just had a kind of gutsy appetite or a gene.
You're just sort of born with that.
Yeah, yeah.
And that has followed you all the way through all the decades. And I love the story about the beaver tail. And when you compare, you know, I'm thinking, okay, well, what might this taste like?
Yeah.
And when you made the comparison with the marrow of a bone, it immediately made me want to skin a beaver tail.
Yes.
tell us the story about that beaver.
Well, this beaver had been destroying our pond. It was the second summer, and they can be terribly destructive. They just bring in this detritus and clog up the drain and the trees all around. They gnaw around the trunk, and then it falls over. And you've seen beaver ponds. They look pretty desolate. So this one had to go. And to make a long story short, a couple of farmers said the only way to do is shoot them. And, well, I didn't know how to hold a gun. But eventually, we did purchase a gun, and my son-in-law said he would shoot the beaver. And he waited noon and dusk, because that's when the beaver surfaces. And then when he came, he toyed with him, played things on the surface of the water. And about the third morning, I heard the shots go off, and I thought, he's got him. And he dragged him up the hill, and I can still see that beaver lying in the glistening, with glistening fur in the driveway. And there's something, it was a very atavistic impulse that said, we have to honor him. We've killed him, and we'll honor him now by eating his liver. And my son-in-law and his wife looked a little bit disturbed, but they had to admit it was awfully good. So we ate the liver, we ate the haunch and a stew. We were going back to New York, so we couldn't eat the whole thing. I think they were very grateful. But I insisted that we do this dish for beaver tail, because years ago I had worked on a game cookbook with a fellow editor, Knopf, who was a real hunting, fishing man. And Evan had contributed this recipe of fried beaver tail. I knew we'd never done it because... But I felt almost... He had died then, and I felt I almost wanted to honor him, too, by proving that recipe was good and could be done. Well, you've seen a beaver tail. It's like pure leather. So I had to scrape and scrape all that leather off. Then you got down to the meat part, if you could call it that, and then you poach that slowly to tenderize it, and then you drain it, and then you dip it in breadcrumbs and egg and more breadcrumbs and put it in hot fat. Well, I thought it was absolutely wonderful. I mean, again, that crunchy, crunchy exterior and this unctuous taste inside. And what it really reminded me of was marrow. It wasn't pure fat, it was marrow. And I thought it was heaven, but my daughter and her husband were ready to go back to New York and bury the rest of the beaver at that point.
Well, I think it sounded really good. One of the episodes in the book that I thoroughly enjoyed, because I have a passion for Hawaii and travel to Hawaii quite often, was when you went to visit Chris Vandercook. Now, he lived with you, he and his sister lived with you.
Yes, we became their guardians. Their parents died, and they came to live with us when they were 11 and 13. Yeah.
And then Chris moved...
He moved out to Hawaii.
Into which island?
The Big Island.
Oh, the Big Island, my favorite. And you mentioned a number of the foods that, of course, everyone eats. But tell us about the musubi.
About the which?
The musubi.
Oh, yes. I think that was the one that the ex-governor of Hawaii had told us. It was made with Spam?
Spam.
Yes.
It's like Spam sushi.
Yeah. They love Spam out in Hawaii. I can't tell you why. And I thought, of course, he was kidding me, you know. You must get this musubi and made with Spam.
Yeah, he absolutely was not kidding you. That's the ubiquitous Hawaii snack.
I know. We saw it on many, many menus.
Yeah.
But it was fun. And again, it was a new taste. I wouldn't say I'd go home and make it. But what was particularly fun to me was that when those children first came to us, that had a very troubled childhood, and nobody really took care of them except the maid of all work, Gigi. And she cooked about three things for them: chicken, hamburgers, and chocolate cake made from Duncan Hines mix. And, you know, that was what their palates were used to. So when they first came to live with us, I said, you know, we love to cook, and we're very experimental, and we do all kinds of crazy things. And this, but it's a very important time of day. We're going to get to know each other this way. And just don't say anything. If you don't like anything, push it away. But don't say, oh, or can I have something else? Because you can't. And so they agreed. We had wonderful dinner hours, little by little. But Chris was the most suspicious. And he would take a fork and put the food on it, and he would scrape it off with his teeth without his lips touching, as if to say, I can eat it, but I don't have to taste it. So to me, it was just wonderful, that trip to Hawaii, because he wanted to show me the real Hawaiian food, but not the fancy stuff of the resort inns and things like that. And we really had a great time. And the last day we came home to his kitchen, which was a big mess, and he didn't have many pots and pans, but he had a rice cooker. And we'd bought this lovely fish. I said, I don't have anything to cook it in. And he said, well, let's put it on top of the rice in the rice cooker. And we grated ginger and, you know, put some nice herbs on it. And sure enough, it was absolutely delicious. So taste, it heartened me so, because taste can be acquired. And if you don't just stick in those childhood prejudices, but open and start tasting and let your lips touch the food.
Yes, and he did. His palate blossomed.
Yeah, it was very rewarding.
Yeah, that was a great story. You haven't worked just on cookbooks. You've worked with authors of many other topics.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Including poets.
Mm-hmm.
To Langston Hughes and Sharon Olds.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Anything you can tell us about working in that area?
Well, for one thing, I think it's very good not to do just food. I think you get jaded. You do too many cookbooks. If it's only a part of your work, you're more selective. And I really tried to be very, very selective. But I've also always loved poetry. And for a while, I did more poetry, but we later got an editor who just dealt with poetry as a specialty. What I find very interesting is to discover how writers use food as a way of telling about character, or poets as a way of just celebrating life.
Mm-hmm.
Galway Connell, the poet, lives on the next hilltop to us in Vermont. He's a great food lover. There's a poem he writes about eating oatmeal all by himself. And then pretty soon, I think it's Keats or Shelley, comes along and eats oatmeal with him. And he just moves from this very physical morning act of his into the realm of sharing it with other poets. Such a beautiful poem. And it's fun to look for that in your writers.
Now, when we got to this point in the interview, I immediately thought, oh my goodness, wouldn't it be fun if I could find the poem? Of course, with the internet today, that's really easy. So here is Oatmeal, read by KRCB's Peter Cooper.
Oatmeal. I eat oatmeal for breakfast. I make it on the hot plate and put skimmed milk on it. I eat it alone. I am aware it is not good to eat oatmeal alone. Its consistency is such that it's better for your mental health if somebody eats it with you. That is why I often think up an imaginary companion to have breakfast with. Possibly it is even worse to eat oatmeal with an imaginary companion. Nevertheless, yesterday morning I ate my oatmeal porridge, as he called it, with John Keats. Keats said I was absolutely right to invite him. Due to its glutinous texture, gluey lumpishness, hint of slime, and unusual willingness to disintegrate, oatmeal should not be eaten alone. He said that in his opinion, however, it is perfectly okay to eat it with an imaginary companion, and that he himself had enjoyed memorable porridges with Edmund Spenser and John Milton. Even if eating oatmeal with an imaginary companion is not as wholesome as Keith's claims, still, you can learn something from it. Yesterday morning, for instance, Keats told me about writing the Ode to a Nightingale. He had a heck of a time finishing it. Those were his words. I had a heck of a time, he said, more or less, speaking through his porridge. He wrote it quickly, on scraps of paper, which he then stuck in his pocket. But when he got home, he couldn't figure out the order of the stanzas, and he and a friend spread the papers on a table, and they made some sense of them, but he isn't sure to this day if they got it right. An entire stanza may have slipped into the lining of his jacket through a hole in his pocket. He still wonders about the occasional sense of drift between stanzas, and the way here and there a line will go into the configuration of a Muslim at prayer, then raise itself up and peer about, and then lay itself down slightly off the mark, causing the poem to move forward with a reckless, shining wobble. He said someone told him that later in life Wordsworth heard about the scraps of paper on the table and tried shuffling some stanzas of his own, but only made matters worse. I would not have known any of this but for my reluctance to eat oatmeal alone. When breakfast was over, John recited To Autumn. He recited it slowly with much feeling, and he articulated the words lovingly, and his odd accents sounded sweet. He didn't offer the story of writing to Autumn. I doubt if there is much of one. But he did say the sight of a just-harvested oat field got him started on it. And two of the lines, "For summer has o'erbrimmed their clammy cells," and "Thou watchest the last oozings, hours by hours," came to him while eating oatmeal alone. I can see him drawing a spoon through the stuff, gazing into the glimmering furrows, muttering, "Maybe there is no sublime, only the shining of the amnion's tatters. For supper tonight I am going to have a baked potato left over from lunch." I am aware that a leftover baked potato is damp, slippery, and simultaneously gummy and crumbly, and therefore I'm going to invite Patrick Kavanaugh to join me.
Sharon Olds, can you tell us anything about what you found in her work?
Yeah, I think Sharon Olds, she's a very sensuous writer, and she dares to write about what it is to be a woman in all our physicality, sexual, just motherhood. And she, again, is somebody who loves to get people together and loves to make food for them. It doesn't creep into her poetry too much, but you find little
tiny
suggestions
bits, yeah,
of it. But the very sensuousness of it goes with, I think, the pleasure of food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I find her just a very physical,
yes,
poet.
Yep, very.
Judith Jones just about took my breath away with her mention of Sharon Olds. Olds has been one of my favorite poets since I first heard her read at the Sitting Room in Cotati in the late 1980s. Because she is from San Francisco, we know it is our beloved Dungeness Crab she writes of in Crab, read today by Danielle Kane.
When I eat crab, slide the rosy, rubbery claw across my tongue, I think of my mother. She'd drive down to the edge of the bay, tiny woman in a huge car. She'd ask the crabman to crack it for her. She'd stand and wait as the pliers broke those chalky homes, wild red and knobby, those cartilage wrists, the thin orange roof of the back. I'd come home and find her at the table, crisply unhousing the parts, laying the fierce shell on one side, the soft body on the other. She gave us lots because we loved it so much. So there was always enough, a mound of crab, like a cross between breast milk and meat. The back even had the shape of a perfect ruined breast, upright flakes, white as the flesh of a chrysanthemum. But the best part was the claw. She'd slide it out so slowly the tip was unbroken, scarlet bulb of the feeler. It was such a kick to easily eat that weapon, wreck its delicate hooked pulp between palate and tongue. She loved to feed us, and all she gave us was fresh. She was willing to grasp shell, membrane, stem, to go close to dirt and salt to feed us, the way she had gone near our father himself to give us life. I look back and see us dripping at the table, feeding her row of pink eaters, the platter of flawless, limp claws. I look back further and see her in the kitchen, shelling flesh, her small hands curled. She is like a fish hawk, wild, tearing the meat deftly, living out her life of fear and desire.
Well, talking about eating alone, towards the end of the book, before the recipe section, which we will talk about, but Evan, who you were with for so long, mm-hmm. Evan died in 1996.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like that was when you discovered the joys of eating, preparing food for yourself, mm-hmm. meals for yourself. And talk a little bit about that. I think that's really an important thing to discover.
I think it's terribly important because so many people just feel, I can't do it. And I wondered myself whether I would really enjoy it. But I found that the first night that I really prepared a nice meal and set the table, and lit the candles, and turned on some music, and had a glass of wine, I just felt that I was carrying on something that had been an integral part of our marriage, as a more than a ritual, something that we both found such pleasure in. And I just felt I was no longer alone. I felt his presence. It was a lovely, lovely feeling. And I haven't turned back. I always cook for myself when I come home. And I like restaurants less and less because they're so noisy and you don't hear as well as you get older. And I just find that in the afternoon I start thinking, what have I got in the refrigerator? Do I need to stop at a vegetable stand? Or I think through the week for the basics and then stop. And the minute I get in the house, my little dog greets me and I start cooking and I smell up the place, you know, my hands smell of garlic. And it's just a very satisfying pleasure. And I wish that I could help young people to understand this, because I think once they get hooked, they'll know what I'm talking about. And this nonsense of not having time is ridiculous. It takes just as long to stand in line and wait for a, you know, prepared dinner, bring it home, heat it up. I do my dinner in half an hour.
Yeah, I completely agree with you.
Yeah.
You're absolutely
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
And it's a good thing for people to hear over and over.
Yeah.
Now, in the recipe section, what was the guiding factor in the recipes that you chose to include? And I have to tell you, there's some of my favorites. Shepherd's pie.
Uh-huh.
Anything with sorrel. In fact, I just made sorrel.
Don't you love sorrel?
I just made sorrel soup mm-hmm. a week ago. I love sorrel.
Do you have it this time of year?
I grow it.
Oh, you grow
and
it.
And also,
yep.
there's a nice little farm,
mm-hmm.
and she grows it as
mm-hmm.
well, and I get it from mm-hmm. her. And then also celery remoulade.
Yes.
Those are just three of my favorite
yeah.
things in the world, so I was happy
well,
to find
Well, I hadn't
them.
Thought at first that I would do recipes, but one thing guided me was that I had some stories to tell, and they were connected with the dish. And maybe they didn't quite fit into the flow of the chapter. I mean, the chapters do have themes, like what is taste, or growing things, what I discovered in northern Vermont about growing things. So it was a way of getting in those stories, for one thing. But I also realized that they belonged, because it was nice to go back to some of the earliest dishes that I did, and then when the whole sort of French and European influence was part of me, and Evan, and so I think that that they added a dimension to the book, and the stories went with them. And I really feel that almost any dish you do does have some kind of a story behind it. And, you know, you don't have to do the same dish twice, exactly the same. You always add a little something or take away a little something, or you might have run out of lemons, so a drop of vinegar will give the acidity.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to have very relaxed recipes in that way. And then I wanted to also show what you could do if, as a loner cook, you suddenly had an impulse to buy a whole duck. And so I call that Wanna Buy a Duck.
Oh, yeah, you can make great work of a duck when you're solo. I've done it many times. Do you have any current projects in the works?
current projects mm-hmm. of books I'm working with. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have a wonderful book coming by Ann Mendelsohn about the whole story of milk. And it's a frightening story in a way, because the more she dug into it, you realize how the food industry has really corrupted what we call milk. But she also has some fascinating stories about the whole part of the world where they never drank fresh milk because it turned sour within 24 hours. So it was yogurt or all the fermented milks that were part of the diet. It's wonderful to trace a subject like that and get to know it again. And we take so much for granted. So that's going to be an exciting book.
When will that be out?
Next fall. It takes almost a year in production. Yeah.
Well, Judith Jones, I'm so happy that you were able to include Mouthful on your book tour. I know how rigorous book tours can be, but it's been a real joy to talk to you.
Well, it's been a joy to talk to you. It's such fun to talk to people who really love food.
The Tenth Muse, My Life in Food, by Judith Jones, is available at your local bookstore. Mouthful ends 2007 with two new features. First, we hear from our new book critic, Laura Hager.
I'm writing about the book I read. I have to sing about the book I read.
Okay, I'll admit it. When I first saw Kitchen Literacy by Anne Valaisis, I was put off by its subtitle. How We Lost Knowledge of Where Food Comes From and Why We Need to Get It Back. There's been a dozen books published on that topic recently. What's left to be said? Quite a lot, it turns out. Kitchen Literacy is a bracing intellectual history of how Americans' relationship to food changed as we moved from the agricultural to the industrial to the information age, or as Valaisis sees it, when it comes to food, the lack of information age. The book begins in a garden belonging to Martha Ballard, an 18th century midwife with 9 children who, in her spare time, wrote a detailed diary chronicling everything she cooked. What strikes Valaisis most is Martha's intimate knowledge of the ingredients she used, from the crisp green beans she picked in the garden to the chops from a lamb raised by a neighbor down the road. Martha embodies the eat locally mindset that foodies assure us will be our salvation. Valaisis views Martha's garden as a sort of prelapsarian paradise, and she spends the rest of the book detailing how far we've fallen. Only 6 years after Martha wrote about her baked lamb, the publisher of American Cookery added a chapter to help people choose food in public marketplaces where one had little or no knowledge of the food's origins. Should you need to tell the age of a goose, the book advises, pinch the web between the goose's toes. It's tender and transparent in youth, but grows thicker and coarser with age. Valaisis is a master of this kind of sensual detail. Her musings on how larger societal forces like the Irish potato famine and the railroad shaped American eating patterns are equally enlightening. As the physical distance between producers of food and consumers grew, the question arose of how to preserve food and then sell it to a skeptical public. Cans did a pretty good job of preserving food, but not flavor. No one could see inside the can led to the evolution of packaging and ultimately to branding, which, oddly enough, was seen as a form of consumer protection, replacing the farmers you know with the companies you trust. Just how trustworthy were some of those companies? Not very, it turns out. There were industrial millers who cut their flour with chalk dust, canneries who sought to solve the problem of gray canned peas by adding poisonous dyes like copper sulfate, and in the early 20th century, industrial farmers whose heavy-handed use of pesticides like lead arsenate made pesticides such as DDT seem positively innocuous. Backlash was inevitable. Valaisis does a masterful job of detailing America's first pure food movement in the late 19th century. But the juggernaut of industrial food production rolled on, aided by advertising and the new science of home economics, which viewed food as fuel, calories, and nutrients rather than a sensual pleasure. Valaisis finishes the book with the counterculture's effect on America's cuisine, though she's a bit shaky on how the health food movement, which was as Puritan in its own way as what it opposed, ultimately morphed into the roll-around naked and mascarpone foodie revelry that we know today. Kitchen Literacy is being positioned as another shot across the bow in the culinary culture wars, but it's better read as an interesting account of past battles. This is Laura Hager for Mouthful.
Na 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 na, na 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 na.
We have a new feature on Mouthful, The Good Cook's Pantry. You'll hear it each week at the end of the show. A good cook can make almost anything taste good, but with the best ingredients, it's a lot easier. One of the most important elements of cooking, no matter what fat phobes and other finger waggers say, is butter. Good, pure, high-fat butter. Butter is packed with nutrients, including essential butyric acid, which helps create brain neurons and slows the growth of a variety of tumors. Because everything, residual pesticides and antibiotics as well as nutrients, concentrate in fat, it is important to use the purest butter you can find. Most butter sold in supermarkets is 80% butterfat, the legal minimum. The remaining 20% is made up of water, milk solids, and various impurities. Most butter travels thousands of miles and is stored in huge warehouses before reaching its final destination. It is often rancid. Butter is a commodity, the price set much as pork futures are. But there are also what we can call boutique butters, delicious butters from small producers in England, France, Italy, Ireland, and throughout the United States. In Sonoma County, we have excellent choices, including organic butter from both Strauss Family Creamery and Clover. But our butter has just gotten even better with the release of Clover Farmstead Butter. Like farmstead cheese and estate wine, farmstead butter is made where the milk is produced. In this case, at the new creamery at St. Anthony's Farm in Turok, just across a walkway from where the cows are milked. It is churned in batches. Most commercial butter is made in a continuous churn, which allows for tremendous quality control. After it is churned and washed, the butter, around 85% butter fat, about as high as it is possible to make it, is seasoned with sel gris from Normandy and packed into ceramic crocks. The taste is extraordinary, clean and fresh, with suggestions of sunlight, sweet grass, and a briny sea. Look for Clover Farmstead Butter in your local market or gourmet shop, and tune in next week for another look into the Good Cook's Pantry. Mouthful, the Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour, is produced by Robin Pressman, Wendy Nicholson, and Michelle Jordan. Peter Cooper and Daniel Kane were our guest readers. Mouthful's new book critic is Forestville writer Laura Hager. Visit her website at streamingmaniac.com. Mouthful's engineers are Lawrence Alberti and Mark Fuller, who also edited this episode. Have a very happy new year, and meet me back here next Sunday at 7 for another yummy episode of Mouthful, the Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour.
Mouthful is produced and hosted by Michelle Anna Jordan. Lawrence Alberti is Mouthful's engineer. For more information about Mouthful, send an email to mouthful@michelleannajordan.com. That's Michelle with one L. You can also download Mouthful's free podcast from krcb.org or from iTunes.
She's cooking something good, so let's bow our heads and pray.
Listen to the Lord, let praises be. It's time for dinner now, let's go. We got some beans and some good cornbread. Now listen to what the preacher said.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the 286-horsepower TL Type S with a solar sensing climate control system. Learn more at Acura.com.